It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. UPMC says that 12 people at Children's Hospital, including 6 infants and 6 staff members, are being treated for the antibiotic-resistant staph infection known as MRSA. UPMC says only one patient is showing any symptoms of the infection, but results are still pending for others. Dr. Amish Adalja is an infectious disease expert at Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. He is based here in Pittsburgh. Dr. Adalja, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start off briefly. What exactly is MRSA?
MRSA stands for MRSA, or methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. So this is a type of staph that is resistant to a specific antibiotic, and it's been something that has become a scourge of hospitals, and it's also found its way into the community. We hear about sports teams having MRSA infections as well. So this is one of our major infectious disease-resistant threats that we deal with on a day-to-day basis.
How is it spread, though?
MRSA, like I said, is a type of staph. So it often lives on the skin or in the nose or in the armpit or the groin of somebody just normally living there, not causing any problem. And we call that colonization. And what can happen is people can pass that on from person to person. They can also pass it on using items like gym towels. So it's not hard to transmit because it's something that's on your skin.
So there are people that are carriers, but who is it likely to infect? Are the people more susceptible?
There are definitely people that are more susceptible, and you have to become colonized with it first to have an infection. And when you're talking about this current news story, what we're seeing there is neonates being colonized and infected with MRSA, and we know that neonates have less potential to ward off colonization with MRSA and less potential to ward off infection. But other people can get infected just by getting a nick on their skin. People who have immunosuppressing conditions, diabetics are more at risk. People who are obese are more at risk. So there's lots of risk factors that allow MRSA to go from colonization to infection.
6 of those infected here in Pittsburgh or exposed to it are newborns. So how dangerous is MRSA, MRSA, for those little ones?
Anytime you're talking about an infection in a neonate, somebody who is in an intensive care unit just after birth, it's going to be a serious consideration because they have very little reserve. Their immune systems may be underdeveloped or just developing at that time. They are often hooked up to lots of machinery, so they've got a lot of tubes and lines coming in and out of them, which make infections much more harder to treat because they can stick to some of that material. They often have other problems going on because maybe they're in the neonatal unit because their lungs aren't developed appropriately. So they have much less reserve, so you treat these infections much more aggressively in that population because they have the potential to be more serious than in someone who is not a neonate.
How does it present itself? I understand it can be associated with pneumonia.
MRSA has many, many different presentations, and pneumonia is one of them. We also can have skin infections. When you talk about people getting that spider bite that you might have heard about, that's often an MRSA skin infection. MRSA can cause bloodstream infections. MRSA can cause heart valve infections. It's a bacteria that can basically get into any part of the body and can cause a varying degree of infections. But in neonates, we will be talking about bloodstream infections, pneumonia, skin infections. That type of thing is what people would be looking for in that setting.
As an infectious disease expert, when it comes to such diseases, how tough is it to contain MRSA?
Right now, we have about a dozen antibiotics that are effective against MRSA, even though it's a resistant one. So it's not one that we have trouble treating too often in the hospital setting. But what ends up happening is that there are some infections that are very severe that we get to too late or that the body itself doesn't have a good resistance to, and they can become fulminant or very, very severe, and they can become very challenging to suppress the MRSA with antibiotics. So it's that part of it can become challenging. The other issue is when you're in a hospital setting and you have transfer of that between patients and between patients and staff, that can be difficult to break that chain of transmission. And what you'll probably see in this outbreak is people doing cultures of individuals who don't have any symptoms, trying to figure out who is colonized, who is not colonized, and then decolonizing those patients and those staff members, and also trying to figure out the exact clone of the MRSA, what its genetic signature is, because there are many different types of MRSA, and you want to make sure that they're all the same, so that if this is truly an outbreak, you would expect them to be all the same genetic strain of MRSA. So all of that stuff would probably be coming out in later days, but that's part of a general investigation like this, and I know that the Pennsylvania and Allegheny County Health Departments are involved, so I would suspect that that type of investigation will be performed.
Should the public be worried?
I don't believe the public should be worried. MRSA, like I said, is a scourge of hospitals. Hospitals know how to deal with it. The fact that this is happening in a neonatal ICU is understandably causing people to be more concerned about it, but hospitals have been dealing with MRSA for decades, and this is something that we have proven measures. There is a CDC guidance document that really outlines how hospitals can get this under control. So I suspect that what you'll see is a very proactive approach from the hospital to this problem, and hopefully it will be ended very soon.
Dr. Amesh Adalja is a physician and infectious disease expert at Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. He's based here in Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There was a 41% drop in the number of fatal overdoses in 2018 from the prior year in Allegheny County. Health officials credit, in part, the widespread availability of naloxone, or Narcan, but also collaborative approaches, including treatment for addiction. Joining us now is the newly named Director of Physician Services at Gateway Rehab, Dr. George Lloyd. He's a fellow with the American Society of Addiction Medicine. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin.
Gateway Rehab, founded in 1972. You've been involved in treating addiction for years. How has the approach, the technique to treat drug addiction, changed during your time in treating that?
Well, one of the changes that's probably made a dramatic improvement is the incorporation of medication-assisted treatment as opposed to strict abstinence, especially when it comes to opiate use disorder. That's been historically kind of really tough nut to crack. That's what caused the institution of methadone clinics back in the late 60s, early 70s, which helped and does help a lot of people. Today, we also have buprenorphine and naltrexone for people with opiate use disorder.
So, how have the detox services changed? And do you include, you know, the new medications as part of the detox services?
Yes, primarily buprenorphine for opiate use disorder. In the past, they would use non-opiate detoxes, which, depending on the person and what they had been using, could be bumpy at times. But the problem is, once you're through detox, what then? You know, historically, it's been abstinence-based treatment with cognitive behavioral therapy, 12-step, things like that. But for a lot of people, one reason or another, it wasn't successful. Now that Gateway Rehab incorporates buprenorphine in the detox, and if the person wants, it gets started so they begin a maintenance of buprenorphine to be continued after they leave Gateway, helps get them on the right track. And again, it's not just the medication, it's everything combined, the therapy, because there's a lot of psychosocial issues that need addressing and for the person to have long-term meaningful recovery.
Everything. What about the involvement of family as a support system? How does that play into it?
Well, that's really key. You can recover with or without family, obviously. However, if you have a strong support in your family, that is, for all ages, for young and old, that's very important. And incorporating them in the overall treatment plan is one of the things they do at Gateway early on, and it's key.
What have you learned regarding best practices through the years, but also adapting them to the individual needs of your patients?
If you look at programs that have absolutely the best recovery, it's what they have for airline pilots and physicians and sometimes other healthcare workers. And it incorporates everything that's NIDA, National Institute of Drug Abuse, finds to be significant for improving chance of recovery. Like it starts out with detox. And then if there's medication available to help the person, also addressing other issues, like if they have some kind of mental health disorder that can be improved with medication, that's addressed. And then the therapy, which usually is cognitive behavioral therapy. That can,
right.
And then the one thing that the physicians and the airline pilots have that most people don't really have is the intense long-term monitoring, where it's not that after 3 to 6 months they're on their own. For physicians, it's a 5-year monitoring program for the initial agreement, and it's pretty stringent. They'll test docs randomly a couple times a week.
You founded your practice, Evidence-Based Recovery, several years ago. 2004, was it?
Yes.
Okay. And your approach was comprehensive drug treatment. What do you mean by that?
Well, just what I was talking about a moment ago, where the person gets evaluated, and most of what I see as an outpatient are opiate use disorder patients. Next to that would be alcohol use disorder, but primarily it's all opiates. And so get them on a medication, monitor the medication. Don't just prescribe them a month's supply and wish them well and hope they stop using, but bring them back, you know, frequently, like every week for a period of time, and then test them every time, which it's the rest of the program is cognitive behavioral therapy, where I don't offer that, but there's a lot of facilities that do. And encourage them to go to 12-step and get a job so that they all around get on with their life.
Right. How does that approach sort of dovetail into the mission of Gateway Rehab?
Perfectly. Gateway Rehab's always had a strong cognitive behavioral therapy approach. They get involved in the psychosocial aspects of the patient to try to give them their best chance of recovering. In the past, without the opiate, patients that have opiate use disorder, without the medication, it was really hard for people early on to stay on track. And now there's a better chance they can do that, and they can continue it after they leave the inpatient facility.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Dr. George Lloyd, the new Director of Physician Services at Gateway Rehab. The opioid crisis over the last few years, has it changed your personal approach to dealing with drug addiction?
It's kind of more the same, just more dangerous these days. The fentanyl doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room for a person that's injecting an unknown dose of this really potent substance into their bloodstream. There's not a lot of room for error. And, you know, and even with the Narcan or naloxone, there's still, it depends on how quickly it's gotten to the person because, you know, from oxygen depletion, there can be brain damage occurring before the naloxone even gets in their bloodstream.
Has the focus on medication in treatment, has it changed at all in light of the opioid crisis of what you use to help the patient?
Well, not so much directly with my practice. And at Gateway, coming on the heels of Neil Capretto, followed by Jason Kirby, they've really gotten more comfortable with prescribing buprenorphine to opiate patients. I think that's helped. And, you know, outside of that little microcosm, there's been a lot more availability of medication-assisted treatment for patients where, like the Medicaid HMOs, they've, for the most part, have relaxed their prior authorization requirements so that if you have that insurance and that diagnosis, you can get it.
Mm-hmm. Neil Capretto, your predecessor at Gateway Rehab.
Yes.
Right. Although the number of fatal overdoses declined sharply in Allegheny County last year, is this crisis still increasing the volume of patients? I mean, so we know that the number of people dying from drug overdoses has declined, but is that any measure of people still addicted, though?
No, I don't think it really accurately reflects the number of people with active addiction. Some people will, especially early on, they might change course and head in a different addictive direction rather than staying with the opiates that they see as more dangerous.
We're going to have to leave it there. Dr. George Lloyd is an expert in addiction treatment. He is the new director of physician services at Gateway Rehab. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Oh, thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
In the 58-year history of the Billboard Hot 100 charts, only two artists have managed to get five songs from the same album to the number one slot. Michael Jackson was the first artist to do it on this day in 1988 with Dirty Diana. The song from his Thriller follow-up Bad was preceded by four prior chart toppers: I Just Can't Stop Loving You, the title track Bad, The Way You Make Me Feel, and Man in the Mirror. In 2009, after Jackson's death, the song re-entered the charts thanks to digital downloads. For 90.5 WESA, I'm Hannah Gaskell.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Allegheny County residents are no longer required to fill their cars with a special blend of gasoline in the summer. The Environmental Protection Agency announced Friday the county is exempt from a 1990s rule that was meant to reduce air pollution during warmer months. 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed visited the get-go on East Carson Street to see what people know about the rule.
Have you ever heard of summer blend gasoline?
I just know that they blend them different in the winter and in the summer.
It's supposed to help, I can't remember now.
Is that the stuff they say on the news, like when they say Ozone Action Day and that?
There's a black hole up there. And you women that use hairspray, you're ruining it.
That was Wills Cooley of Zelianople, Jamie Williams of El Rama, Chad Ebert of Jeanette, and Dave Fitzwilliam of the South Side. For our occasional series, A Moment of Science, Liz Reed spoke with Carnegie Mellon University professor Peter Adams about why the air pollutant ozone is dangerous when it's on the ground level, but protects us when it's high in the atmosphere.
What is ozone?
Ozone is a special form of oxygen that has three oxygen atoms combined together in a way that they normally don't like to coexist. The form of oxygen that most people are most familiar with,
Because we breathe it,
is molecular oxygen, which is just two oxygen atoms combined. Ozone has three. Two is kind of the magic number because the oxygen atoms sort of fit together like jigsaw pieces. They're very, quote unquote, happy that way. And ozone is, you kind of have a third wheel and it's more reactive.
How does ozone form?
Ozone formation is one of the more complicated topics in atmospheric chemistry. But the simplest way I know how to explain it is you need something called volatile organic compounds, which you can think of gasoline vapors and other things like that. You need nitrogen oxides, which comes from vehicles and power plants. You need it to be sunny, and generally you need warmer temperatures for ozone to form at the ground level.
Why is ground level ozone bad? This is something we don't want to form, right?
Right. You don't want to breathe ozone. It's a pollutant. It's an irritant to the respiratory system. It's a risk factor for asthma, for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And exposure to ozone is also associated with an uptick in different kinds of death from respiratory disease.
So ozone at ground level is a bad thing, but way up high, it's a good thing. Why?
The simplest explanation is that when ozone is up high in the ozone layer, about 20 miles up, you don't have to breathe it. If you did, it would still be equally bad for you. But the benefit of having ozone high up in the atmosphere is that it absorbs and blocks ultraviolet radiation from the sun that can give you skin cancer.
So I'm a child of the 80s, and I remember hearing a lot about the hole in the ozone layer. This was a big deal. Where did that hole come from?
So the ozone hole is ultimately caused by a set of compounds that we call chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs.
And those were coming from primarily from aerosols and things like that?
So they were used as propellants in spray cans. They were used in refrigerators and air conditioners. They had a variety of applications. They were also used in styrofoam packaging. Once we understood what was causing the ozone hole, and then through also a political and international process, have almost completely reduced the production of CFCs. And so the thing that was causing the ozone hole, we've essentially almost completely removed from the global economy.
That was CMU Environmental Engineering Professor Peter Adams speaking with 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed. Find more on this story and others in our Moment of Science series at WESA.fm. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Unemployment is at the lowest levels in many years. The stock market has been rising for the better part of a decade, but not all are benefiting from the growing economy. PublicSource.org is trying to chronicle some of these stories. Their project, Low Wage Living, explores how Pittsburghers get by in lower paying jobs. Joining us to talk about the perceptions and realities of this work are PublicSource.org reporter Oliver Morrison, Jeff Shook, Associate Professor of Social Work at the University of Pittsburgh, and Elisa Manspeiser, Executive Director of Landforce, which helps restore and maintain land with crews comprised of people who have faced some barriers to enter the workforce. Welcome to all of you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for reporting.
Oliver, I'm going to start with you. For the purpose of your reporting, what does it mean to make a low wage?
Well, a low wage can mean a lot of things. Like, one of the primary ways people probably think about it is if someone's earning a wage and they're still in poverty, that's a pretty low wage. And we know that there's about 7 million workers in the U.S. that are working, but they're in poverty. Some other people have been talking about it in terms of maybe making 200% of the poverty wage. And so that means, like, when you look at that, that's a really big number. And it means for a lot of those people, they might not even have like $400, say, if they needed a car repair to happen, that they couldn't get a car repair because they just don't have enough extra money.
So how does it manifest itself day to day, including that, you know, that car repair, if you would?
Right. So, I mean, I'll just talk about someone who, because for part of this series, what we did is we've looked at issues, but we've also really tried to talk to a lot of different Pittsburghers across the region and in the Mon Valley and see what it's really like. And so I talked to a guy named Jordan Simpson, and he had a flood in his basement at one point, and his bed was ruined. And he was sleeping with his son and his girlfriend, and he didn't have enough money to replace his bed. So he just had to sleep on the couch. And, you know, that's not, you know, I think when we hear the stories of the economy doing well, of unemployment being so low, you know, that's not the picture that we have, but that's the reality for a lot of people in our region.
Jeff and Elisa, when you heard, maybe read some of the stories, whether it was a single mom of three or a deaf person trying advance in the workforce or someone maybe with a prior conviction, how did they resonate with how you understand the situation going on in the Pittsburgh region? Jeff, let's start with you.
The reporting definitely resonated with what we're finding through our research. And part of what we're trying to look at here is even this concept of moving beyond thinking at the poverty level. We see workers struggling who are making well beyond what we would consider, you know, poverty and below poverty. They're struggling to pay bills. They're cutting meals. They can't get medical costs. They have health insurance, but they can't get medical care that they need. They're in medical debt. They have to adapt a lot of strategies to try to make ends meet on a daily basis. And they're not getting a lot of support. So a lot of workers that we're looking at are not using public benefits.
Making decisions, either or kind of decisions?
Yeah. What do I pay this month? Do I pay the light bill? Do I, you know, do I eat? Do I, you know, skip meals for my kids? There's just a lot of choices that are being made on a daily basis. And again, we're not talking about folks earning at the minimum wage. We're talking about people who are making $11, $12, $13, $14, $15, $16 an hour and are working really hard and working overtime.
Elisa.
So it, along similar lines, for me, the article showed how whether you're earning $7.50 an hour or twice that at $14 an hour, it's still really hard to get by. The example of Kiana, who's a mom of three, who was only earning $7.50 an hour and bringing home $300 a month. How do you ever expect to live on $300 a month? But even Joey, who was earning $14.20 an hour, was unable to have an independent life because mm-hmm. he couldn't pay for rent and food and everything else that he would need to pay for on that salary.
Do you hear from similar types of stories from among your employees, your workforce?
So, yes. And just to clarify, we hire people temporarily mm-hmm. with the object of getting them into better paid jobs, ultimately getting into better paid jobs. So when we hire people, we're doing a lot of training and a lot of workforce readiness training. We're doing some financial management skills and all sorts of things that will help them be both better employees as well as live healthier lives. Mm-hmm. So what we're hearing from them is that they go through cycles of different kinds of jobs, right? And sometimes they may be earning $10 an hour, sometimes they may be earning $12 or even $15 an hour, but they're not able to keep those jobs. And it's the instability of not being able to keep a job for whatever reason, because there's all sorts of things that are going on in their lives that we that they really struggle with.
You're helping them take the next step up, improvement within the economy?
That's our goal, and that's their goal as well.
Oliver, one of the people that you profiled in this series was a hearing impaired man who was trying to improve his standing within the economy. Is that an unusual story? Somebody is really trying to, okay, here I am, but really to have a decent living, I need to be up here.
Well, I think it's not unusual in the sense that when the economy went down, a lot of the people that traditionally might have gone on welfare or received public assistance in a particular way were pushed into disability or something like that. So there's a lot of people that have some sort of disadvantage. Maybe it might be a hearing disability or something like that, that as the economy is recovering and there's more work and wages are starting to creep up a little bit, are trying to find their way back into the workforce. So it's not unusual in the sense that, like, The workforce is now, just for the first time 15 years later, trying to find space for people like that. But whether or not it's going to be worth it for someone like Joey to get into the workplace, it's hard to say for some of them. They're making tough decisions.
Five states have recently passed laws that raised the wage to $15 an hour. This year, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, as part of his budget proposal in February, asked for an increase in the state minimum wage over a period of a few years. That proposal was not included in the budget. Lisa, from your vantage point, what impact does this comparatively low minimum wage have on workers in the Pittsburgh region, would you say?
I think it makes it harder for people to live their lives fully. I think it makes it harder for them to live their lives with health, and they really struggle.
Jeff?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, we in this region, our wages are low relative to other similar types of regions. And I think the minimum wage is a necessary step in terms of raising it to following Governor Wolf's proposal, is a necessary step to helping to improve the lives of workers. We do know, so for a long time, research on a minimum wage has looked at the macroeconomic effects. And there's a lot of new research out there that's showing that the effects are minimal on employment, on inflation. But what we're starting to see is studies saying that when you raise the minimum wage, you see fewer suicides. You see better mental health. You see a lot of other outcomes of well-being. So I think we really need to move beyond those macroeconomic effects and understand what this means for people.
Low-wage industries in the Pittsburgh region, are they reflective of much of the nation? Is our area an outlier?
Well, one of the things we know for sure is that there's a racial disparity. Like, we know that disproportionately African Americans in the Pittsburgh region are unemployed. We know that they are making a poverty wage at a higher level. If you look at the median income in the city of Pittsburgh, white Pittsburghers make nearly twice as what black Pittsburghers make. And I think if you think about some of the stories that I reported on in terms of some of the African Americans whose lives I entered into, they often had big traumas that they were dealing with that were historical traumas that they were inherited. And so there's a lot of different reasons for that disparity, but some of it is historic.
Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are differences geographically. When you look at a place like Seattle, where the minimum wage was raised, it's on its way to 15. It's a booming economy there, right? It's a different economic context there than we're seeing here in Pittsburgh. So I think we have to think about geography and how that plays out. But we also know there are some underlying things that are very similar. And in both Oliver and you, Kevin, you've spoken to the strong economy out there, that we see a lot of money being generated, but it's not going into the hands of workers. Like, wages have been pretty stagnant and they're creeping up some now, but this isn't the low unemployment rate is not right now helping workers. And we see that largely across the board. And we see workers in a lot of regions struggling. So we're a little bit different, but there's a lot of similarities.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about the realities of low wage living in the Pittsburgh area. Jeff, you've written that $15 is just a useful guidepost and doesn't necessarily guarantee financial stability. Would you explain that for us?
Yeah, we have, out of a study that we're doing following workers who are getting wage increases, we've done a number of analyses to look at this question. One is using the Economic Policy Institute's basic budget. And what we're finding is workers who are making more than needed to make ends meet, they're still struggling in a lot of ways. The other thing we're looking at, I did an analysis of workers in our sample making $15, $18 an hour. They had a lot of struggles too. So we're seeing it. It's a much more nuanced picture here. And the fight for 15, that rhetoric, it caught on. But the idea is we got to think even beyond at this point.
Elisa.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think we use the $15 an hour as a way of talking about creating positive workspaces and figuring out what it is that will value our workers and value our employees and make them feel respected and then let them feel committed and valued so that they will in turn be really good employees.
How is the financial burden of a low wage compounded over time? Oliver?
Can you say what you mean by that?
Well, in the sense of you don't have that sort of safety net, that rainy day fund.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, so I think, well, part of that manifests itself in that, like, a lot of low-wage workers don't have a really set schedule. They don't have benefits like sick leave, so if they have to, like, take off to take care of one of their kids, like, that means that they may miss their job or something. You know, when I already mentioned Jordan, but he's gone through a lot of these different jobs, working at gas stations and Walmarts, and part of it is that, like, you know, he has a kid to take care of, and he needs to find, you know, sometimes he struggles when his hours shift so quickly to find someone to take care of him. His family helps a lot, but that's still really hard for him.
Jeff?
Yeah, and we see it in our work as well, that we see that group of workers making $15 to $18 an hour. They're a lot of hardships, medical hardships, financial hardships, housing hardships, and they've been working for low wages for many, many years. They've been in the industries that we're studying, and they've been working for these low wages, and their wages are coming up now, but they've got accumulated hardship, especially medical hardship. So a lot of workers are dealing with medical debt. They can't access medical care that they need, despite the fact that they have insurance.
How do repeated pressures like that exacerbate the stress or even the psychological pressure on someone, especially over time, if it happens time and time again? Elisa.
So at Landforce, we do a lot of trauma-informed care because the groups of people that we hire and that we train have accumulated a lot of trauma over a long time, from the time they were children, either because of the neighborhoods they lived in, because of hearing repeated gunshots, or not having schools that that gave them the kind of education that they deserve, or not having the strong family background. We see that how trauma influences people's ability to hold and keep jobs.
Your nonprofit, Landforce, has pledged to raise your minimum wage from $13 an hour to $15 an hour for seasonal employees who complete an initial training program. 13 already well above the state mandated minimum. So why was it important for you to raise wages even more?
Well, $15 an hour provides a little bit more stability. As we just talked about, it doesn't provide complete stability, but it's a good stepping off point. One of the arguments against raising a minimum wage is that, you know, $7.50 an hour is just a starting wage. But people don't find themselves in a starting wage. They find themselves in a trap that keeps them there forever.
We have just 2 minutes remaining. So with Pennsylvania legislators not choosing to raise the minimum wage, is it up to organizations, is it up to businesses to sort of take the lead to raise the wages rather than being required to do so? Jeff, let's start with you and just go around.
Yeah, I mean, we do see that there's some large employers in the region who have kept wages down. So I do think it's incumbent upon them to raise the wages. And it's incumbent upon, you know, the business community to really think about the well-being of workers. I also think there's a public policy role beyond the minimum wage, and that is thinking about other ways to support workers.
Elisa.
If a small organization like Landforce with a $750,000 budget can raise the minimum wage in the organization to $15 an hour, there is no reason that any other business of the same size or larger couldn't do the same.
Oliver, is that what you're seeing, private businesses and organizations taking the lead?
Well, I think historically, getting people to make these big changes voluntary is a risky proposition. I think what we see is that there's been a decline in union membership that has been making it so harder for people to push for higher wages. And I think, as you mentioned, legislative action. So I think that obviously any individual's action to a business owner or anything helps and makes a difference. But ultimately, the people need to be able to have power to push for wages, better wages for themselves.
All right. 20 seconds, Oliver. How's Public Source going to be covering this issue in the coming days?
So you'll continue to see profiles from us. You'll also see us focusing on specific issues like healthcare, what happens when you're an elderly worker, which is a growing workforce, all these kinds of things. So yeah, check out this. It's a lot of my colleagues have put in a lot of time to really make this to help tell the stories of these people that just we're not hearing from in this story of the rising economy.
Oliver Morrison's a reporter for PublicSource.org. You can find the project Low Wage Living at PublicSource.org. Jeff Shook is an associate professor of social work at the University of Pittsburgh. And Elisa Manspeiser is the executive director of Landforce. Thanks so much to all of you for coming in today. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the United Way of Southwestern Pennsylvania has a new leader. We'll talk with Bobby Watt Gear about the giving environment, plus a visit with a Pittsburgh area resident who wants to make sure flags are retired properly and honorably. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.